ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In 2007, a charismatic Englishman who ran a doomsday cult from his living room in WA vanished with his partner, their child and a friend.
He asked me what planet I was from.
He's a very odd guy.
Something wasn't right.
I'm Dominique Bayans, host of the new season of Expanse, The Nanup 4, where we dive into a murky world of cults, control and secret identities. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, straw poll. Is Bluey's dad Bandit, yes, a cartoon character, a perfect role model for Australian fathers? Or does he set unrealistically high standards for modern dads?
You know, Bluey's father, Bandit, is, you know, a model for many men's groups, fathers groups, of a very engaged father who spends a lot of time playing with them and never seems to have to go to work.
Hello, Natasha Mitchell with Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. Looking today at fatherhood, its past and its present, the book Fathering, an Australian History, draws on a century of personal accounts to examine how the expectations and experiences of dads have changed over the decades and the way they've remained the same, and how this role affects families and society at large. Let's join some of the authors at this event at the Royal Historical Society of Victoria. Later we'll hear about parenting and work, but first a discussion on fathering and mothering with the convener of the Australian Fatherhood Research Consortium, Deakin University's Professor Jackie McDonald, from the University of Newcastle's Fathers and Families Research Program, Associate Professor Richard Fletcher, who's also a principal investigator with the SMS for Dads and SMS for Deadly Dads support lines, and fathering co-authors from Monash University, Dr. Johnny Bell, an oral historian, Emeritus Professor Alastair Thompson. Asking the questions today is President of the Australian Historical Association from Macquarie University, Professor Michelle Arrow.
So I'd like to start with Jackie, and your research investigates men's mental health and wellbeing and how it impacts on and how it affects family life. And I wonder if you can tell us, how do men experience becoming fathers today, and how did your ideas about that change, or were they reshaped by reading Fathering?
I think one of the things that really resonated with me, and the first thing that resonated with me, was that this idea that fathering comes in many guises. And what we don't often see is that heterogeneity around stories of fatherhood really expressed in the public discussions we have about fathers. And what we saw in the book were really beautiful, rich stories of different beliefs, different attitudes, different ways of parenting, different ways of communicating, different ways of relating that didn't fit into one mould. And I think one of the reasons why that's important to really think about in the current discussion is that we still hear this homogenisation of fatherhood. Fatherhood is one thing. How will we support fathers? What do we do with fathers? What are the messages that we deliver to all fathers, as if it's just one single entity? And we know that that carries forward to the messages that fathers hear, because they say, am I doing this right? As if there's a right way to father. And, you know, one of the things that we saw in the beautiful stories was this negotiation of that role. Fatherhood is a social role. All social roles are negotiated, and we negotiate them with our partners and with our families in general, and we bring to them those histories of the relationships that we've had in our own past with our families of origin, and we bring to them the pressures that are part of the socio-historical period. And so just being able to express that heterogeneity, I think, was one of the really first important things. I might just, on a second point, something that really resonated with me right from the beginning was this idea of nurture and care being something that was discussed and talked about right from the outset at the beginning of the last century. And, I mean, we obviously talk about that a lot now, but I thought, of course that's the case, because nurturance isn't owned by mothers, it isn't owned by women. It's something that we really innately all have as part of the way that we share care. And when we deny that richness of experience and of nurturance to men and to fathers, and we know that language around nurturance changes in adolescence, boys are really told that that's feminine, and they shift the way they talk about their relationships in a way that will inform their fatherhood into the future. And at the moment, we know the World Health Organization just recently released its social commission report on social connection, and declared, I guess, an epidemic of disconnection. And in Australia, one in four fathers say they feel socially isolated or lonely. And so this idea of the more rich understanding of care is really important to building connection generally, not just with your children, but with your partner, with your families, with society more generally. I guess one other thing that really struck me were these, I guess, self-serving forces that then pass on a message of what manhood and fatherhood should look like. So there was really one example of a building company that talked about owning a home, I think, being the hallmark of fatherhood. And, you know, that message at a time of a housing crisis and housing insecurity, that still resonates today, that idea that that's part of my role, and that it creates stress, it creates a sense of failure, it creates shame. And they're the things that those kind of assets that we provide, you know, this session we're talking about mothering and fathering, we're now seeing that much more as a partnership in how we provide for our children, how we engage as nurturant carers. It's very hard to shift those provider roles, those breadwinner kind of ideas around who should be doing that. They're really deeply seated within the sort of psyche around what fatherhood, what that role entails. So I guess I'm concerned that we still have those kind of economic self-serving forces that are driving messages around manhood and what it should look like. We see it in gambling advertising, we see it in pornography, we see it in those sorts of areas where somebody's making money out of these men at the detriment of families and fathers themselves. And while I'd like to finish on a really nice note, my concern is that AI will continue to drive that. And I wonder whether our big challenge is to how do we drive AI so that supports the whole breadth of ways that fathers might engage in care and support their families.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way to open up this panel, I think. You've raised a lot of issues that I think will come up in some of the other discussions.
Yeah.
Richard Fletcher, you're the leader of the Fathers and Families Research Program at the University of Newcastle, and a lot of your work focuses on providing support for new dads. You say that, you know, often the focus in when a baby comes home is on the mum, and the dad is viewed as, I think you kind of said that, they're seen as optional extras in the process. And of course, that's really terrible for mothers because it puts a lot of extra pressure on them, but it's also not great for dads. And I wonder if you can tell us a bit about your work and kind of the tools that you've used or that you've developed to support new fathers, but I guess also thinking about how you responded to the book in the context of your own research.
Well, I also responded by thinking, what a fabulous book. Where has this been? Why have they waited so long to produce this, you know? I've been working with fathers about 40 years and I think this is such a useful resource for fathers, and I can think of hundreds of conversations with fathers where we were lacking a context, we were lacking a sense of other forces around us, making it more difficult usually to sort out how I could be the father I would want to be. We've been developing messages for fathers through the SMS for dads, sending text messages to dads because dads don't go to a lot of events and clinics and things like that. So this reaches dads through their mobile phones. And that's now a national program for fathers from 12 weeks in the pregnancy through to the baby's a year old. And we've had 20,000 fathers sign up for this. It's a big group of fathers. And the feedback from those fathers is very positive about this resource. But in the feedback is a thread of messages about, somebody's caring about me. Somebody's asking me how I am. Somebody's looking out for me. One dad wrote back and said, it's sort of like having a mate put his hand on your shoulder. That's what the messages feel like.
And that sense that they are battling through this process of figuring out how to be a dad by themselves is a very strong feeling in the feedback about that. But I did wonder then about the other extent. I know that it's recognised that many family members in an Aboriginal community might have a role as a parent, but we're just starting a project out in the middle of the desert, Central Australia, in the Nutanjara community, and they are very clear that all the mother's brothers are fathers to a child. And so I don't think yet we as a white community have really taken on board just the basic notion we have, not just that there might be gay parents or there might be extra grandparent whose role is, but a much broader notion of parenting. And I think generally I don't hear it. We find it very difficult, and I find it difficult as a researcher trying to build that into a program that says, if you're the dad, we'll send you the messages. And in that community, they're saying, well, that won't work here. It's not just him. In fact, he doesn't have a role in a lot of ways. It's all her brothers that have the roles of discipline, guidance, and so on. So there's just that broader notion of Indigenous communities' ideas that I'd like to see come out. And the final point, if I can make it, in my work, we work with services, health services, education services, and that's where, although the book, I thought, makes a wonderful connection between the policy level, not just paternity leave and so on, but general policy level and what dads think and do. In the middle there's those services, the midwives, who, not intentionally, but who tell dads very clearly, you are the secondary parent, you don't really count, and so on. So there's all those service level factors which I see on a daily basis in my work as very important for fathers. So I'd just been suggesting to Alistair, this is the next book. he told me he's looking around for a project that he feels a bit lost. so I've suggested one.
That's excellent. Richard's done his homework and now he's suggesting more homework for Al, which is great. Richard raised some really interesting points there, I think, around how men learn to be fathers. And I was going to turn to you, Johnny, as one of the co-authors of this book. I mean, you wrote your PhD on kind of ideas of fathering and the way our ideas of fathering have changed over the 20th century. And I think one of the interesting themes in the book is the way that men often talk about fathering, and it's sort of across different time periods in using words like traditional and modern. And some men talk about, I don't want to be the kind of father my father was. Some people say my father is a role model for me about how to be a father. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how have men learned to be fathers over the last 100 years and how has that changed? Or has it changed?
They've learned slowly for a start, and they've learned from their own fathers to a certain extent. It always seems to be a bad lesson that they're absorbing from their fathers. And I think one of the things our book does very well, it paints this picture of men who want to do better. They've always got this sense that fathers in the past, including their own, didn't quite live up to the right standard, and that they themselves will do better. They'll be more nurturing, more involved, more helpful. And the culture has always been there to help that, to promote that. There have always been, I suppose, cultural pathways that allow men to, you know, express themselves as a father. Some of the more fundamental questions, I think, have been left off the page, such as, you know, how do we kind of make this whole parenting thing more fair? But there have certainly been many opportunities for them to do it, to become better fathers, more involved, more engaging, more caring.
And Al, of course, you are also a co-author of this book. And one of the things that comes through in the book is while there are, on the one level, there's these kind of dominant ideals about what it means to be a father and mother, you know, what fathering and mothering mean and what they have meant over time. It's also interesting that so many people live outside those ideals. So while we think of them as being enforcing, there are actually lots of people that, you know, they don't live within those prescriptions, I suppose. So I wonder how, you know, how did men over the period that you're examining understand and what it meant to be a good father? And how has that changed over that period?
Yeah, there's so much in that question. Thanks, Michelle. I mean, one of the things you realise is that early in the 20th century, fathering or fatherhood is primarily understood as this is your role is to be a breadwinner and you can do a bit on the side, but that's what you really have to do. And that does shift across the 20th century, thanks in large part to feminism in the 70s and 80s. But the book is exploring the ways in which cultural expectations about fathering, mothering, family life shift across time, but shapes what men do and can and can't do, but also the structural and systematic pressures on families. You know, the basic wage early in the 20th century sets it up so that a man's wage is basically sufficient to keep a wife and three kids in reasonably frugal comfort, and women's wages are set much lower, and therefore it just structures in. Men will be breadwinners, mothers will work at home, would raise the kids, although working class mums often also had to work as well. And so the book is trying to explore how both culture and structure systems impact upon the decisions everybody makes in family life about who's going to do what and how they shift, and that decision-making shifts across time. And what you see is men that are forced into positions they don't necessarily want. And just occasionally, and we loved writing about where there are 15 portraits of different fathers and families across time. And the one that I'm probably most fond of is Herman Mendel, who's a classic example of a man who doesn't do what's expected. So he's a working class dad. He's a painter and decorator in the early 20th century. Got four boys, three schoolboys and one infant. And his wife dies. And there's no welfare for single dads. He has to keep working. And ordinarily in that situation, dads would either marry quickly to find someone else to look after the kids, they would farm the kids out to family, or the kids would end up in an institution. And Herman doesn't want to do that. And he moves the family across town to where Auntie Beryl lives in a street. Auntie Beryl's kids have grown up, and Auntie Beryl says she'll look after the infant while he's at work and the three boys are at school. And Herman keeps the other three boys at home and he learns to cook. And his youngest, well, not the youngest, the youngest of the three boys at home, Arthur, talks beautifully in an interview conducted in the late 1970s for the National Library about his dad learning to cook and dad learning to do meat and veg, but also learning to make puddings and so on. And he talks about when they first started off, Dad managed to have enough money to pay a housekeeper. The boys hated the housekeeper because she talked all the time, so they had a vote, got rid of the housekeeper, and they decided they would help out. So boy number two learnt to cook, and they managed it. And Herman develops this extraordinarily close relationship with his sons. Arthur in particular just remembers sitting with Dad taking him to sport, reading books to him, etc., etc., alongside doing a full-time job. And the sort of lovely part of this story is that Arthur then becomes a dad in the 1930s with two little daughters. And I've listened to a lot of interviews done later in life about men in the 20s and 30s and 40s about their fathering, and almost no one talks about it like Arthur does. Mm. He talks about, my kids, when we were kids, we waited till Dad came home. We waited at the front gate when he came home from work. My kids did that for me. I washed nappies, I bathed the kids, I read them stories. Yes, I had a job, but I did all that as well. And it's a lovely example about how a man could, if you like, work against the expectations and the really terrible structural pressures to be the sort of father he wanted to be, but also how he then transmitted it to his son Arthur, who was such a different sort of father because he had a role model for a father who was active and engaged. So it highlights how there are structures and cultures that shape what you can and can't do in family life, which are often very powerful and very forbidding. But through the book, as Jackie mentioned right at the start, there are people who, if you like, cut across that. And Indigenous dads, I have to admit, the greatest education for us in working on this research was not only learning about how Indigenous families had very different, more extended kin ways, and that uncles could play roles, and when dads were missing, uncle would stand in. And then, as you were yourself involved in the Indigenous fathering movement that really takes out of Aboriginal men's health in the late 20th century, and there's this extraordinarily supportive network for fathers, and Indigenous fathers get a bad rap often, but actually really trying to support and to be uncles, older Aboriginal men being uncles for younger Aboriginal fathers. So there are structures and cultures, but also there are decisions that we make as fathers about how we're going to do it.
I was just curious, Al, whether you thought that experience of loss allowed Herman to step into that space, because one of the things that was written in the concluding chapter I thought that was really interesting, and that Richard and I know we see this from experience, is this idea that if we don't create space for the father, essentially those embedded roles become entrenched and they just become the way that family operates, and then we just see this cycle, intergenerational cycle, perpetuated. I mean, it's an awful experience, but he stepped into the roles that we would call traditionally maternal, Herman did, and on the other hand, reading it, it just felt like who he was. So that idea that I think that I was saying that I think we are all nurturer and carers, that it is just part of our repertoire of caring, but it wasn't suppressed for Herman because he really was had that opportunity.
I mean, I think you're right. Herman, there was a loss and he stepped into the gap. It was really hard for a working class bloke in the 1920s to do that. That's what's so exceptional. And he had to draw on all the resources he could, including his own to make and his son's to make that possible. Most working class dads, and Johnny's done research on this, most working class dads, if they were widowed or mum wasn't there, they lost the kids. And the welfare in the 20s and 30s assumed that fathers couldn't raise kids.
That was an extraordinary part of the systemic pushback, that men could not look after kids and that they should not. They were a danger, if anything, to a child. And so the first preference was for the child to be taken away from the family. So the men who pushed back against that were of a very particular mindset. Mm-hmm. It did create a space, but the question is, you know, what sort of man steps into it? What sort of man is able to imagine themselves in that fully nurturant role? And there are very, at that time, very particular, very small category of people.
I mean, sort of connected to that, one of the take-homes from the book, and you talk about what's the space that enables men to step up and do that. And one thing that becomes really clear when you listen to a lot of fathers' stories is that if you're not a primary carer with the primary responsibility in the first couple of years, you probably never will. Because you won't feel confident, because wages will be structured in such a way it's harder for your partner to go out to work and so on. And that's as true now as it was in the past. And so that's one of the reasons why paid parental leave schemes are so important in those first few years. And if they can enable, as they do to an extent in Scandinavia, there's a reason why you see a lot of dads pushing prams in Copenhagen and Stockholm, because they can actually have 6 months on their salary. And if they don't take it, they lose it. And as soon as you do that, then fathers step up.
We've talked a lot about fathering, obviously, but the panel's also, you know, we're talking about fathering and mothering. And I wonder if our ideas of good mothering have changed as much as our ideas of good fathering have changed in the last few decades. Maybe we could start with Jackie.
I think for both mothers and fathers, it seems that everybody has taken on all of the extras that the role roles might demand, but not given away anything. Mm-hmm. So everything feels like everybody should be everything now to their children and their families. And men and women will feel that differently depending on what resources they have available. And again, this becomes negotiated, but it becomes negotiated from a position where usually in heterosexual relationships, the father is a little bit older. So a couple of years more advanced in careers, and then probably going to be earning more anyway, even if they were the same age, and then the parental leave. I mean, there's so many structural barriers to creating those moments that you're talking about where you learn to be competent. I mean, I remember from my own experience, you know, there's a lot of trial and error. You're learning with your baby how to get this baby to settle, and you just have more time to do that than the father typically has. And so there's just that moment where you're thinking, well, we all want to rest. We all don't want to hear that sound anymore. We all want to sleep. You take the baby. And so the moment that starts, it becomes part of the habit, it becomes part of the pattern. So it's very tricky under all that pressure and all that tiredness to start to change those patterns as well.
I mean, I guess from the history, one of the things you learn that, you know, one of the most profound changes in family life across the 20th century is the transformation of a mother's role, not so much in how they mother necessarily, but the fact that they now legitimately and are expected and actually required because of the way that cost of living is to work as well. So mothers are now, as Jackie said, doing these multiple roles. You know, father expectations about fathering have changed, but actually what fathers are doing, and the stats confirm it, what fathers are doing in many families is not shifting anything like as quickly as the way that mothers' roles have changed.
Interestingly, when we ask about who wants to be a parent in the future, there are higher proportions of men who want to be fathers than women now. And, well, I can fancy that.
Yeah, guess you wonder why that might be. On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell, it's an exploration of Australian fathers today on the show, ending there with Deakin University Professor Jackie McDonald, who is the convener of the Australian Fatherhood Research Consortium. You also heard from Associate Professor Richard Fletcher from the University of Newcastle's Fathers and Families Research Program, and the co-authors of a fascinating-sounding book, Fathering, an Australian History, Dr. Johnny Bell and Emeritus Professor Alastair Thompson, both from Monash University. Now, from fathering and mothering to fathering and work now. Let's hear from social scientist, academic and author Belinda Probert, University of Melbourne Professor Sean Skelmer, whose book is A Fair Day's Work, The Quest to Win Back Time, and another co-author of the book Fathering from the University of Melbourne, Emeritus Professor John Murphy. And he's back now to host and president of the Australian Historical Association, Professor Michelle Arrow.
Okay, so in this panel we're going to focus on the ways that men's paid work and employment policies and practices have really impacted on fathering. And you can already hear from the discussion in the first panel how important that workplace breadwinner role is in sort of defining and determining what fathers do. And we're going to kind of think about some of those, the ways that fathers and families, but also society and policy, might make paid work less of an impediment to active and effective fathering. I just wanted to remind everyone of the most recent household income and labour dynamics in Australia data, which is sort of known as the shorthand HILDA data, released in March this year, which found that Australian men are not doing any more housework than they were 20 years ago, and women are still doing 50% more housework than men, even though the amount of hours they spend on housework has reduced. Women are also still doing double the hours of men in care work at home, double the hours of care work than men do at home, a fact that's remained basically unchanged for more than 20 years. This is while women's workforce participation has also increased over the same period. The report interestingly found that men are more satisfied than women with the division of unpaid work in the home. I would say that is very unsurprising. So I'm going to start with Belinda. Now, Belinda, you have not only written a memoir about your own father called Bill's Secrets, but you've spent your career as a professor at Melbourne and La Trobe Universities researching the ways that gender shapes our working lives and the ways that work intersects with family life. I wonder why you think these statistics are so stubborn and difficult to change, and why do women still do more caring work at home than men do, and how has women's entry into the paid workforce impacted on fathering? So I wonder if you could reflect on those things in part of your response to the book.
I want to start by saying that while I'm going to generalise a lot, that I completely accept the first point that Jackie made about actually what's going on is very varied. There are lots of people making different lives out of these structures, but I'm going to be wildly generalising. Because when I was thinking about this, so if we want to talk about how paid work might be made more compatible with fathering, because I think everybody agrees there's attention here, we need some clearer ideas about what exactly it is that we think fathers should be doing more of. And I'm not sure that there's a relevant we, as in what we think fathers ought to be doing more of. I think we mothers would like fathers to look increasingly like us and do pretty well what we do as mothers, apart from giving birth and breastfeeding. We want fathers to do the same caring work, cooking, minding, driving around and so on, the same emotional work, listening, noticing, encouraging, showing intimacy and so on. And mothers and fathers might decide that they'll teach their children different things, baking versus woodwork, knitting versus fishing, but they would put in the same amount of effort in each respect. I'm not going to claim that I know what fathers would like to be doing, but I suspect it's not the same as what mothers would like them to be doing. And as the book shows, fathers have always found ways of radically being different kinds of fathers, and there have been great examples of that already. Fathers may feel that they should be doing some of the things mothers suggest, but these may not be in their self-interest or inherently attractive. Women pushed hard out of self-interest to change the relationship between mothering and paid work, beginning with my generation. Maternity leave, part-time work, flexible working hours, working from home, all come out of this push. But what made any of it possible was not fathers taking any more time to do things with children, but the provision of childcare. Men didn't really have to change much at all. And why would they? I remember thinking when my children were young, how incredibly good it would be to have a wife who worked in an interesting job part-time, which would help pay the bills, but also relieve me of the responsibility of organising childcare, school holidays, shopping and so on, let alone doing most of the housework. And I have to say, actually, that's very unfair. My husband did more shopping and cleaning because he had higher standards than me, but I'm generalising. I'm generalising, and we know the evidence. And as one of the new fathers who's interviewed in this book says, would I have agreed to reverse roles had I been wise before the event? And I think not enough is said about how boring much childcare is, standing in the park at the swings, driving children around. Now, the way Australian cities have evolved, it's nightmarish, really. We should think about how to reduce this kind of parenting, not make more people do more of it. Fathers have not, it would seem from this book, done much pushing to get themselves more time for childcare and domestic labour generally. Nor have they been keen to take advantage of parental leave provisions, part-time work opportunities. The male breadwinner model suits many men very well, would suit me very well. It's a cultural norm, but it's shaped by men's interests. Money and income keep fathers at work, and this history shows so clearly how earning power shapes the way childcare is shared. Am I concluding that changing working hours is not key to more active fathering? Yes, I am. Which is not to say that they're not critical to active parenting. However, our focus today is fathering, which is not the same thing. So I have four conclusions to suggest. First, I think it's obvious women need to earn more. In East Germany, at the time of reunification, women had the highest participation rate in the world. There was almost no breadwinner model there. Universal provision of childcare running 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. at minimal cost. They worked in all sectors of the economy, including the military. In the West of West Germany, only half women worked, and childcare was seen as an option that you had to pay for, and it was a personal choice, and it rarely ran all day. There was not a lot on offer and expensive. Guess which system won out? By 2007, in reunified Germany, only 40% of children under three had access to a childcare place. And I wonder what impact that had on the distribution of mothering and fathering work. In Australia, it's possible we'll have to revive the feminist critique of the bourgeois family. I learned from this book that Australians make relatively little use of paid childcare compared to the rest of the OECD, which surprised me. So it seems that Australian parents spend the most time caring for children in all OECD countries. It's not clear this makes our children happier, let alone their mothers. There's these stories, growing stories of grandparents getting increasingly fed up because they're the backstop if you don't approve of paid childcare. It's the grandparents. And it's possible, I think likely, that we've hugely overinvested in this particular ideology of motherhood in Australia. I mean, it's worse here. There are other countries where it's not as bad, in order to make this seem bearable and indeed necessary. So the third point is relying on the nuclear family to bring up children is a very recent and very untested method of raising children, only made possible by men's breadwinning earnings. And it's in men's interest to protect this model as things now stand. The example of Aboriginal families, let alone many other cultures, and the numbers of people who are involved in parenting, we just have to remember this. We're a little blip, what we have now. So my final point is, for the four-day week, which is being much discussed at present, and I'm very pleased, I myself have campaigned around this in the past, probably do nothing to change fathering. Same goes for working from home. All these changes, same old, same old. There was a great piece in the Financial Times last week about the Netherlands, where the four-day week is very widespread, and how it hasn't, one thing it hasn't changed is the relationship between men and women in families. My daughter, my son-in-law, my daughter-in-law all work a four-day week, not to spend more time with their young children, but to spend more time with themselves, separately, I should add. And I think it makes perfect sense. So I think that it's possible the only lever we really have to increase the time men spend on being fathers is for women to spend more time at work and have good careers and earn good money. Arlie Hochschild wrote a fantastic book about various things related to this, and she concluded the key is the power to stay away from home until around 6 p.m. is the key, thereby creating space for men to be intimate with their children.
That's fantastic. Thank you. And I think it deserved a round of applause, absolutely. I'm going to come back to you on that, but I want to go to Sean Scalmer. Sean, you've recently written a book called A Fair Day's Work, The Quest to Win Back Time. And that tells the story of workers' campaigns for basically limits to the working week, like the eight-hour day and the introduction of the weekend. I wonder, I mean, these campaigns often, I think, centred on the kind of figure of the white male worker and the family, you know, the male waged worker. But how did fathering figure in those campaigns to win back time? And I guess, how did you reflect on the book in relation to the work that you've been doing on time as a commodity for workers to fight for?
I mean, I think one of the interesting things I found in the research is that the eight-hour day campaigns of the middle of the 19th century, actually the campaigners did talk about parenting, and these were campaigns that were in the interests of white men. They talked about the importance of the eight-hour day for a number of reasons. Mm. It was partly about the opportunity to participate in politics, partly about the experience of autonomy, partly about educating yourself, but the family was absolutely central to the arguments as well. So workers talked about their experiences of going to work in the darkness and returning in the darkness, and they said that they wanted to play a bigger role in family life. A unionist memorably said, I think in the 1880s, we want to exchange the ring of the hammer in the workshop for the burble of conversation by the family fire. But it should be noted that these campaigns didn't seriously engage with the work that was being done in the home. So the whole push to reduce hours of paid work was based on the idea that what was happening at home wasn't work. Yeah. I mean, the famous slogan was, you know, 8 hours labour, eight hours recreation, 8 hours rest. So when you're at home, after doing your 8 hours, there was no more work to be done. So this was really, you know, an obvious limit to campaigns around hours all through the 19th and the 20th centuries until the rise of, you know, the women's liberation movement. There were women actually writing in the 19th century to into newspapers saying, hang on, this eight-hour day thing sounds like a great idea. You know,
can we have one too?
Exactly, yeah. But men's ears were deaf to those interventions. And then it was really the force of the women's liberation movement that broadened the understanding of what work was and then helped to transform the conception about what reducing working time should be about, so that it should be about thinking about the distribution of work in the home as well as for paid work. And, of course, that is a campaign which still goes on in a new form. I think one of the things the book shows is the combination between agency and choice and structure. So there are these finely wrought, really beautifully written portraits of fathers in different circumstances trying to find the way to be better fathers and to father in a new way, hitting the structures of the economy, of which sometimes they're a beneficiary, like the fact that men typically earn more than women, but also limit their participation because they're expected to be at work in order to advance their careers. And it's very clear, or one of the interesting things historically is that as women's liberation changed our notions of work and also a sense of what fathers should do, those changes through the 70s and 80s, and particularly from the 80s, also went along with a time in which employers demanded that workers, male and female, work longer hours. Yeah. So in Australia now, the Australia Institute had research from 2024 which said on average a full-time employee, whether a man or a woman, does 4.1 hours of unpaid overtime every week. Equally, I think the OECD recently did research about the work-life balance and said that Australia is eighth worst out of 38 member countries. Mm-hmm. So there have been clear structural shifts in which we've been asked to work longer hours, and men and women have responded to that in different ways, but it's clear that the pressures have meant that as a result, fathers haven't been as involved as they should be in fathering. And I think that one of the interesting things that the book cites research saying, I think it was 35% of children, 2017 research showed, 35% of children thought that their fathers worked too much. So that kind of broader structural context is shaping how many fathers are fathering despite their best intentions. Yeah. So I'm also in favour of the four-day week, but I do take Belinda's important point that simply reducing hours will not necessarily change the distribution of work in the home or lead all fathers to be more actively involved in parenting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Who wouldn't like a four-day week? Four-day week sounds fantastic. Thanks, Sean. John, you are another of the co-authors of Fathering, and you and Belinda have also written work together about parenting in the 1950s. And the 1950s, I guess, is probably that high watermark for what we understand as the sort of breadwinner homemaker model of masculinity and femininity, of motherhood and fatherhood. Why was breadwinning so important to ideas of fathering in the 1950s? And I mean, of course, it was important to fathering before then, but really, why was it so important in the 1950s? And how did that breadwinner model for fatherhood sort of shape Australia's welfare state as well? So it's kind of had an impact in policy as well as in daily life. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, well, along with New Zealand, with arbitrated male wages, we had, in a sense, the most entrenched model of the breadwinner in Australia. But I think one of the things that comes out in the book is that until the 1950s, it was a story of failure as much as anything. It was a story of certainly men wanting to be that breadwinner, but being able to. So, Eric Hobsbawm described the first half of the 20th century as the age of catastrophes, the First World War, the Depression, and the Second World War. It's kind of like, it's pretty lumpy. Yeah. And then, really, the high tide is the first time, especially for many working class families, that people actually achieve that model that we understand is rigid and restrictive, but was working, if you like. How it shaped, and since then, I think the story that we've told in the book is the way that work has changed since then, then undermines that model, even though it's still there in culture and in some of the institutional structural factors. How that shapes welfare is, to some extent, stunting welfare development in Australia. The presumption of the male breadwinner wage was that those who are in the labour market, men as heads of household, were adequately provided for. You don't actually need welfare in that case, except for those who are outside the labour market, the aged, people who are disabled. So there are quite a few ways up until, the 1970s, 1980s, in which welfare developments are stunted by the fact that we had a good wages system for men. Yeah. Child endowment, for example. Mm. The objection to child endowment from parts of the labour movement was that it would cut the basic wage because the kids were already provided for, even if there weren't any kids. Mm. So there's, I think, across the 20th century, what we tried to explore in the book is both the ways in which that quite strong breadwinner model built into policies and structures actually was not being achieved for the first half of the 20th century, is then being achieved in the post-war boom years and has then, to some extent, unravelled, certainly been perturbed and disturbed by a lot of subsequent developments, including developments of how the labour market works. I mean, the other half of overtime for full-time workers is precarious work.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we've talked a lot about the centrality of breadwinning to fathering sort of culturally is still important, I think. That idea of responsibility and provision is still something that men talk about today when they talk about being a father. But also that sort of idea of being an active, engaged father and being present in your children's lives is very important as well, and that those two things are really sort of in conflict with each other in some ways. How have workplaces and employers responded to this? I mean, what are the factors in play that kind of prevent men perhaps from being those kind of active fathers or from keeping those two things in conflict with one another? Maybe Sean, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I mean, the short answer would be that, again, we're going to generalise, but employers have in general contested restrictions on managerial authority. So, new forms of law that restricted their capacity to deploy labour in ways that suited them and maximised profits, they haven't been too keen on. And so, as a result, plans to reduce hours or legislation to reduce hours or to make work more flexible or to give employees even the right to request work that's more flexible have often been opposed. Of course, there are exceptions, but that would be the sort of the general point. I mean, that's one of the interesting things of the last couple of years out of the COVID pandemic that enforced a shift in how work was done and demonstrated that, for example, working from home became a necessity and many people were able to do it very, very successfully, even though employers had said that it would be impossible. And then despite that, many employers are unwilling to allow working from home arrangements to persist.
Belinda?
Do you think I think it's a very interesting question to focus back in on this question of power in the workplace, because I was thinking about the role of unions in the shift trying to create work that's more friendly to women. And I remember having major stoushes with the shoppies over the fact that they would not contemplate part-time work. That's not very long ago. We're not having any part-time work in retail. It's male, it's Catholic. Get out of here. It was just extraordinary. And you think what retail looks like now. But one of the problems is that union is very, I mean, I don't want to get personal here, I'm just using an example, is very, very powerful politically and terrible in the workplace. I mean, just which is why we have other groups mobilising in the same workplaces, because they do not deal with or cover all those people working not in the big old retail sector. But so it's one of the key problems in all this is the collapse of unionism as a powerful force, and its failure to pick up on the kind of social messages that might garner broader support rather than narrow industrial campaigns, which are really hard. But even there, they're held back by these historic structures of unions and their own particular histories. They've been so important, the unions, in winning things, but also in ignoring things.
I think that's true, although we should also recognise that now women are more likely to be members of unions than men are. So and the two leading national union figures are both women.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Belinda, I want to come back to your prescriptions at the beginning, you know, and it is interesting thinking about what might help move the dial on some of these quite intractable issues around the kinds of issues that you raised around, you know, how do we divide the kind of work of raising children in the home? How do we make these kind of roles more fair? And you kind of pointed out there are some real reasons why they may not have developed in that way. But I wondered, what are the real barriers to kind of making the work more fair and making the division of labour more fair around fathering and mothering?
It is very difficult to generalise. I mean, I'm going to have to stop generalising. Because the differences between the opportunities that women who are now increasingly highly educated have to work in, you know, have better careers. I mean, it is a different world. And for them, there are many more opportunities. And it shows up. They get divorced and they do things like, you know, there's all sorts of indications of the fact that they're not prepared to put up with or want to change the way they live. So you can see things going on there. But for most women, that's not the case. They don't have those choices. And it's obviously true for many men. So I think the difficulty of, and I haven't done research in this area for a long time, so I'm, you know, judging, I heard so-and-so say. But listening to the discussion, I think money is the key. Really, I'll come back to this. That money is what will allow women to push for choice. And it is a bargaining within the household at that level. It's like, you know, if I'm the earning is really critical in that negotiation when it comes to people or couples having different views, money really matters. So while I can see very big changes happening in professional areas where women now dominate in many industries, and, you know, it's a very uneven playing field, I'm much less optimistic about the opportunities for women who... The majority of women who earn miserable wages and work in sectors that are ununionised and disorganised, and, you know, really there for them, that break in family life is critical. I mean, it's just so. I wish I had a solution to that one.
Well, as you
know, women strike. You know, it's like, you know.
Well, they tried that in the '70s, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But also, I mean, I think that rise of precarious work means that you know a lot of people don't even have control over what hours they work, which
absolutely.
Means they're really difficult
yeah.
to
which is back to
negotiate
the unions
those
and
things.
That whole struggle for you know the minimum. I mean, it's when someone comes and says, "Well, we don't have anybody working for less than 4 hours a time." I say, "Yes." You know, this is an employer who will not bring people on, take them off, bring you know that whole. Undercurrent in the current economy. It's a really terrible place to be.
I want to ask if our audience have questions.
Or solutions.
Solutions would be great.
My name's Carla Pascoe-Lay, and some of you know that I have a strong interest in the history of mothering alongside fathering because, of course, they're histories that are intertwined. I guess I really appreciated Sean bringing in the perspective of children in all of this because you've been the first person to kind of really raise what do children want in all of this, Sean. And if we look at contemporary research by the Australian Institute of Family Studies, it shows that both fathers and children want to be spending more time with each other okay? Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to ask ourselves, what's the policy outcome that we're trying to achieve? The Australian government often tells us that the policy outcome we're trying to achieve when we look at family policy, childcare policy, parental leave, etc., is greater workforce productivity and higher maternal workforce participation. I would argue that there's something much more important than that, which is family well-being. And in fact, if we look at what mothers want, what fathers want, what children want, it's often to be spending more time with each other. So I would love to see government policies that are promoting that. And we also have to make a distinction in all these discussions within feminism itself, which is not a unified body of knowledge. In fact, you know, we have maternal feminists on the one hand that have argued for an ethics of care. And Anne Mann wrote beautifully about her time going down amongst the children rather than being up amongst the men. And what she was talking about there, as opposed to neoliberal feminism, which is about women seeking external validation in the workforce, was about recentering the real meaning of life around caring relationships, particularly within families, but caring relationships can come in many guises. So when we talk about work, I think it's indivisible from talking about care, and I would love to see government policy that really centres care and family well-being ahead of productivity.
Do we have reflections on that?
Hear, hear.
I was thinking about this data, the OECD, which really surprised me, the OECD data, which shows that Australian parents spend more time with their children than anywhere else in the OECD. It's tricky to judge what's going on here. I mean, was it really time that's wanted, or is it something else? What's a proxy for what? Because it doesn't really make sense to me that both, that's what everyone wants, and yet we're doing more than anyone else. And I don't think we're more happy than anywhere else.
It just reminds me of interviews we got students to do with fathers and asked them just a couple of questions was, what would you like to do more of that you're not doing now? These are fathers with primary school age children. And a lot of them said, I'd like to spend more time with the kids. And then the second question was, well, have you got ideas about how that could happen? And what I noticed in the responses was that all of their ideas were about things they could do differently at home. Maybe I won't go to the gym so much, or maybe I'll get my wife to do this and then I'll be able to do that. And almost none of them thought of asking their boss for more time off. The workplace didn't come into the conversation when they were thinking about That's what so they wanted. They were all going to solve it within the family. That's what struck me.
Makes me think of Bluey. we finished the book on Bluey, actually, and, you know, Bluey's father, Bandit, is, you know, a model for many men's groups, fathers' groups, of a very engaged father who spends a lot of time playing with them and never seems to have to go to work. And it's an interesting kind of, you know, this imagery of the model father who loves playing with his kids and very imaginatively plays with them. But although he's an archaeologist, so he's a dog that likes to dig up bones. But yeah, he very rarely has to go to work. I mean, there's one episode where the kids are saying to him, you know, can you play with me? And he's saying, well, I've got to go to work. And the whole episode is them enticing him back to play on the trampoline. He doesn't have to go to work.
I might just jump in as well. The other thing that strikes me is that so many of these questions are individualised. Mm-hmm. So particular fathers are saying, how do I solve this for me, rather than it being a social effort, a collective effort, to pursue our notions of what a good society will be. And I think Carla's point's a very good one, that because the economic and the apparent, this, you know, the service of economic goals has so dominated our public life, our attempt or our capacity to define a social vision of a good society and then to pursue it together, you know, has been quite undermined, which has left people in this position of, well, okay, how are we going to solve it as a group of individuals?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really great point to end on. Thank you so much to our three panellists for this panel number two.
So much work still to do, isn't there? With huge thanks to all our guests today, including in that last conversation, social scientist, academic and author Belinda Probert, University of Melbourne Professor Sean Skelmer, and co-author of the book Fathering, an Australian History, University of Melbourne Emeritus Professor John Murphy. Thanks to host Professor Michelle Arrow from the Australian Historical Association and Macquarie University, and to Alistair Thompson and the Royal Historical Society of Victoria for having us. And if this conversation has prompted many thoughts from you about how society might better arrange itself for fathers, mothers, children and all of us, email us. Love to hear from you. bigideas@abc.net.au. That's bigideas@abc.net.au. Yes, you've been listening to Big Ideas, where we bring you big thinkers at the best live events. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and I'll catch you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.